The Genesis Communications Network is sponsored by the U.S. Money Reserve, your exclusive source for gold and silver precious metals. Visit them online at usmoneyreserve.com.
Welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sobadi karup, guten tag, ciao, we viva, catbang, half a day, jai janendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace, how, go vegan, from the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated, McNugget pharmaceutical, vivisection prison, kilitary industrial, poor nation, in the cheese-covered, post-constitutional, bankster, bankrupt, corruptocracy, mocracy, criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the NSA, NRA, USA, home of Uncle Sam Manila, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. I'm looking at the menu from Cafe Gratitude. Somehow I want a refund. I want a refund for all the meals I've ever bought there. And at Gracias Madre, I'd like a refund for all the meals there, too. And a class action lawsuit to go, please. I don't see it anywhere on the menu. And what a positive, life-affirming menu it is. Almost New Agey, but okay, you know. Vegan New Agey, that's okay, right? I'm looking at the menu here, and it's life-affirming, Cafe Gratitude. Our food and people are a celebration of our aliveness, and you gotta love the names of all the dishes here, you know, the soups and salads, and, you know, I am thriving, and, you know, when you order, you say, I am. So, what do you want? You want the, I am thriving. I am fulfilled. I am dazzling. I am pure. I am hearty. I am abundant. I am grounded. I am warm-hearted. I am liberated. I am transformed. These are the names of the dishes here. But I'm still looking all over the menu for the fine print where it says, proceeds from the sale of food here will go to finance the purchase of a slaughterhouse and meat dairy and egg market. A retirement farm in Vacaville for the owners, Matthew and Terces Engelhart. The Beloved Farm. I'm looking for that on the menu here, on where it says, I guess, not really finding that on the menu, but if we look on the internet, on the Beloved Farm, and the love seems to be gone from Beloved Farm for some reason, but if we look for the rationalization for benefiting from vegan restaurants and starting this farm, Terces says, quote, it was a big week as we begin to make the transition into our own meat products after nearly 40 years of vegetarianism. They're not vegan from what their PR people say. They still own, they're still owners of Cafe Gratitude and Gracias Madre. So she says, well, I would clearly say we are in transition, and that transition is happening deep within our beings. We know it is a necessary and important part of our own growth, as well as the sustainability of our farm. Certainly, a part of us wants to either deny the inevitability of death or simply not let ourselves get present to the reality of it for our animals as well as ourselves. Well, you don't have to kill the animals, and the inevitability of the death would be postponed into the future, Terces, but... Okay. So she says, but we know that while we die a little bit each day as we open our hearts further to the presence of love, and this is the excuse for, like, taking money from vegan restaurants and opening a farm where you're going to kill animals and sell their body parts and their secretions. So this is the rationalization. I can't make any sense of it, but perhaps you can, where she says, but we know that while we die a little bit each day as we open our hearts further to the presence of love, and as we are the caretakers of our farm animals, the responsibility for their health and well-being lies with us. This is clearly a longer discussion, and we invite you to one of our upcoming farm dinners over the next 9 months, where we share more about this process. Here, Matthew is straining off beef broth and our freezer full of pastured beef. Our pastured beef. Whew. Okay, so I guess the menu there at Beloved Farm, the menu is, I am stabbed. I am bleeding. I am dying. I am beheaded. That sounds like the menu there at Beloved Farm. Whew. Pretty amazing, huh? So, I mean, it sounds just like another quaint, another New Agey tale of a California couple retiring into the sunset on a small little personal journey to find love and fulfillment. Slitting animals' throats. But in fact, as a, kind of a New Age vegan thing that it says, but it's incoherent in that regard, and it's incoherent, unfortunately, on a much grander scale. It's not just the retirement of a couple to a small smarmy farm in Vacaville. The Engelharts are part of an international conspiracy to save the planet with more increased animal agriculture. The plot thickens. Kiss the ground. No, that's not a menu item from Cafe Gratitude. Kiss the Ground is an organization co-founded by Ryland Engelhart, son of the restaurant's owners. By the way, if I spelled Engelhart incorrectly on my posts on Facebook, it's because it was spelled incorrectly on the Kiss the Ground website. I guess they couldn't even spell the co-founder's name properly. They're not getting anything right on this one, huh? And Ryland Engelhart, son of the restaurant's owners with Kiss the Ground, pushing the totally insane concept of regenerative agriculture, which is the brainchild of a very unsavory character, Alan Savory, whose past admitted environmental blunders include the mistaken murder of tens of thousands of elephants. Whoops. Now he is to be trusted to solve climate change and other environmental devastation with his plan that has been totally debunked and discredited by the world's top climate specialists. But that doesn't seem to deter the Engelharts and the big name and wealthy supporters that they've attracted to this debacle. Advisors of Kiss the Ground include, well, as I mentioned, Alan Savory, plus Marianne Williamson, the non-vegan spiritual leader, Jason Mraz, David Bronner of Dr. Bronner's Soaps, and there you have more vegan money going to non-vegan causes when you buy Dr. Bronner's Soaps. Dr. Bronner is a big supporter of the Humane Society of the United States and Mercy for Animals, etc. And now this, kiss the ground. More like kiss the ground goodbye with this plan, with soil erosion, with resource depletion. You know, so this plan for more cow grazing, increased cow grazing as an environmental solution. Duh. And the donors to kiss the ground include the Al Gore Generational Foundation. You know, veganism remains the truth. Too inconvenient for Al Gore. I don't know how many times he claims to be vegan. People claim he's vegan. Whatever. I mean, could you imagine if he actually, you know, spoke the truth about veganism in an environmental context, in the true environmental context? Okay. Also, a donor to kiss the ground is Cafe Gratitude, Grateful Bowl Donation Fund. You know, so that means you, the customer, that means that I, as a customer of Cafe Gratitude, donating to more cow grazing as an environmental solution, more so-called livestock products, huh? So the Engelhardt's guru, Alan Savory, said there's, quote, only one option left to climatologists and scientists. That's to do the unthinkable, namely to expand and intensify livestock grazing. That is the unthinkable. Why are we even thinking it now? Why are the Engelharts thinking it and doing it? Why would anybody think the unthinkable? There he is. He says it's the unthinkable. Don't even think about it. But that's what we got to do. We got to expand and intensify livestock grazing. And he says by using rotational grazing. And Dr. Robert Goodland, the World Bank climatologist, the world-renowned climate specialist, said of Mr. Savory, quote, first, what he proposes. All right, well, I'll tell you what Dr. Robert Goodland said after the break. Coming up on today's show, we have Marta Zaraska. She's the author of Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Got to get over that obsession. Professor Gary Francione next hour. Join us at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Register at worldvegansummit.com. Prices go up tomorrow night.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
But when you talk about Bernie's campaign, we're talking about a revolution, so it sounds kind of acceptable that it's in the air. People are looking for a revolution. And I would say the World Vegan Summit and Expo is the revolution. Join us, and join us as if the future depends on it, because it actually does. The revolution is here, the World Vegan Summit and Expo, July 29th, 30th, and 31st on the campus of the University of California in Berkeley. And the revolution starts in a revolutionary place. Actually, we're going to kick off the event that Friday morning at People's Park. We're going to meet at People's Park at 11:30, which is the historic People's Park that played a major role in free speech issues and peace activism in the 60s. And so we're going to have the Vegan Because We Care walk. We're going to meet at 11:30 at People's Park and then start our walk at noon. We'll go down Telegraph to Bancroft, up Bancroft, across College and onto the campus. So it'll be about a half-hour walk, a great way to start the festivities for the World Vegan Summit and Expo. The first ever Vegan Because We Care walk, and another reason for you to be with us at the event. The prices for registration will go up tomorrow night, so go to worldvegansummit.com and register, and this is where the revolution is. Well, the truthful revolution. I don't know if you really want to go to the, that so-called animal rights conference in Los Angeles in July. Look at all the speakers there from Mercy for Animals. What? Alan Dara, Nick Cooney, Vandana Bala, Matt Rice, Nathan Runkle. Five speakers for Mercy for Animals. Mercy for Animals just received $1 million from the Open Philanthropy Project to support cage-free egg production, which Mercy for Animals opposed. So who's going to be speaking there? Is this the kind of integrity in a conference where you have five speakers from a group that just was paid $1 million to support something really cruel, horrific? Murder, mutilation, the killing of all male chicks, grinding them alive, suffocating them, imprisonment of females, killing all the hens. Mercy for Animals just got $1 million to support that. Will they be talking veganism or cage-free eggs? Also, the Humane League, look at that. David Conan Heide, let's see, John, on two, three, four speakers from the Humane League. The Humane League just received $1 million from the Open Philanthropy Project to promote cage-free eggs. Who will be speaking, the $1 million donation or animal advocates? The Humane Society of the United States, Paul Shapiro speaking at this ARCon, the so-called Animal Rights Conference. The Humane Society of the United States just received $500,000 from the Open Philanthropy Project to promote cage-free eggs. Not veganism, but to promote the murder and mutilation of millions and millions of eggs with a happy stamp of approval, from the animal rights movement. Wow, it's pretty amazing, huh? And it's pretty amazing that our vegan money went to support a new farm for the owners of Cafe Gratitude and Gracias Madre. Dr. Robert Goodland was saying about the work of Alan Savory, who is also a partner with the Humane Society of the United States in a global livestock association there. But anyway, so Dr. Goodland says of Savory's work, Savory is now the guru to the Engelharts, who are starting this slaughterhouse and meat market, egg market, cheese market in Vacaville. He said of Mr. Savory, first, what he proposes is unachievable. Second, he omits incorporation of a basic element in environmental assessment, and that's analysis of alternatives. Third, he omits any statement as to how long his recommendation would take to implement. And again, he's suggesting increased grazing, more livestock. That's the plan for the environment. Totally, out of whack with reality. Robert Goodland says, one analyst says that Mr. Savory's claim that arid land needs more grazing is untrue. His claim that grazing promotes plant growth is false, and his claim that hoof action is needed to incorporate organic matter into soil, germinate seeds, and filter water is unproven. Anyway, he goes on. I posted about this. Coming up, we will talk to Martyr Zaraska, the author of Meat Hooked, on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We also have a couple of extraneous Bob Linden pages there, so I can have 10,000 more friends. The more friends, the better. The more we can all get together at the World Vegan Summit and Expo and, you know, do our walk, the Vegan Because We Care walk on Friday morning and hang out for 3 days and then go get the whole world to go vegan. That would be the plan. Prices go up tomorrow on registration, so register now at worldvegansummit.com. And we have our job in front of us because people are so hooked on meat, aren't they? Meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. So today we are going to talk to Marta Zaraska, who is a science journalist who's been published in the Washington Post, Scientific American, The Atlantic, elsewhere. The new book from Marta is Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. And this book was featured in the Journal of Nature as one of the best science picks, and excerpt has been in The Atlantic, a big review in The Wall Street Journal. So welcome, Marta. How are you today?
Hi, I'm fine.
All right, and you're staying up late for us. You're
yes.
Where are you now? You're in what city?
I'm in a very small village in France, but it's already 2:30 a.m. So
two thirty in the morning. So thank you for staying up for us, and we appreciate you being with us here today. So my understanding is that we humans are herbivores, and everything that goes wrong with the world comes from our consumption of meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. But you have looked at this. Take us back a couple of million years. Take us back some million years here. It's Meat Hooked, the History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Weren't our first ancestors vegan? And aren't we? Where'd we go wrong? What happened?
So of course, for many millions of years, our ancestors were indeed vegan. And you know, 20, 30, 40 million years ago, we were eating mostly things like grass and tree bark and fruits. This was the diet of our ancestors. But about 2.5 million years ago, they started eating meat.
Who were our ancestors? Like we say, our ancestors were vegan and eating seeds,
yes,
and fruit and all. Who are our ancestors?
So these were hominin species. This was not Homo sapiens, but there were many different species of hominins, which are ancestors of Homo sapiens, so the previous species that evolved into us later on. About 2.5 million years ago, those hominins started eating meat, and the reason for that was climate has changed and the food they had available became much less abundant. And this is something that many people keep forgetting, you know, that especially, you know, the people who eat meat and who believe that meat eating is an extremely important part of who we are nowadays, that 2.5 million years ago, the world was very, very different than it is now. And our ancestors didn't have much choice, meaning that if the food that they had were eating before were not available, they had to eat something. And they needed a diet that was full of calories and nutrients and so on. And meat back then was the food. Back then, it was good for them because basically they didn't have anything better. And because meat was abundant, there were many grazing animals back then, and there were also many carnivores that were killing the animals and leaving leftover meat. We could scavenge it, and it was nutritious, you know. If you were hungry back then on African savannah and you came across leftover, you know, half-eaten zebra, it was a good idea to eat it, and that's what our ancestors did. And
but what changed? Like you say, the fruits and seeds were not abundant. Like what yes. changed to force
the climate? Climate has changed, so it became much drier on the savanna, and the food they had were eating before were not so easy to find anymore. So they had to adapt and they had to change. And this is also something I'm arguing in my book, that our ancestors were, and we are, very opportunistic animals, and that we have always adapted. It happened several times in the past that the climate of our planet was changing, and we adapted. We changed our diet tremendously. And now, nowadays, is a very similar time. You know, like the 2.5 million years ago, when the climate has changed, we started eating meat. Nowadays, you know, climate is changing once again, and not this time it's our fault, and we should adapt once again, and you know, and change our diet,
and change away from meat, because we have to adapt, because it's
exactly.
Destroying the environment. So I just can't imagine, like, the first people who decided, you know, I don't salivate when I see a cow or roadkill, or you know, so it's like I guess they had to be in a pretty you know, in a situation where they were starving for it to be appetizing to eat a decomposing carcass, right? Did they immediately throw the carcass on a fire and say, we need to cook, or, you know, are we going to eat the hairy, bloody remains?
That's how they eat it. They hate it bloody and hairy and with all the brimming parasites. But as I said again, you know, our ancestors didn't have the amazing availability of food we have nowadays. They didn't have whole food around the corner. So if you came across a dead zebra, raw one, or breeding with parasites, it was really good food. You know, because we have to remember, you know, that the realities were very different, and the meat was good for them because it was full of nutrients and full of calories. So you couldn't be choosy back then. Mm-hmm. And you know, even nowadays, for some people who live, you know, in some extreme conditions in Africa or something, you know, if you have nothing to eat, then eating meat is a good idea. You know, you cannot be choosy if you are starving.
Mm. Yeah, so it seems like we could feed the world, though, with, you know, like we say, we feed the poor man's bread to the rich man's cow, the way that things are going now. So, so then tell us more, because you look at our addiction to meat in Meat Hooked through evolution, but also then, you know, we've evolved, and we have culture, marketing, you know, the anthropology, all of these that seem to come along with a couple of million years of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, you know, meat, because as I mentioned before, for a long time in our history, humans were hungry, and we couldn't say no to food that was there and that was nutritious. So, but because it was also so rare and so full of calories, we started craving it and wanting it. And the thing about human psychology is that when something is rare and hard to find, we start wanting it even more. It's the scarcity principle. It's the same thing that operates when you go to the shopping mall and, you know, and there are advertisements saying only two pairs of shoes left, or, you know, only 10 left by now, today, whatever. And this is the same thing with meat, because it was so hard to find later on. You know, in medieval Europe, people didn't have much meat to eat. So they wanted it even more because it was so rare. And at the same time, all aristocracy was eating lots and lots of meat. They were eating even as much as 2 pounds of meat per day per person. This is enormous. You know, when you look at the menus that back then what people were eating, the aristocracy, there was barely anything else than meat. It was astounding. So at the same time, the poor people were eating barely any meat at all. And but they were looking up to those rich people, and they wanted to be like them. So meat became a symbol of power and riches, and just the same way, you know, some fancy watches are today, or some fancy cars. You know, you look at the movie stars and the rich people, what are they doing, and you want to be the same. So in middle-aged Europe, in medieval times, you know, meat became such a status symbol, that if you had it, it meant you were rich, and people were craving it for also for that reason.
That explains Trump steaks, I suppose, then. That,
yes, it actually does. It's because also meat, you know, meat, actually even animals use it in the same way, that meat is a particular food because it's not only full of calories, but it also spoils very fast, and it's rare, once again, too. It's hard to get it. So, for example, chimpanzees, they share meat to form political coalitions. So if a chimp kills a little monkey, Kolaba's monkey, and he will use the meat to give it to some of his partners, but not to others, to show who is the most important to him and who he wants on his side. And our ancestors were doing the same thing. When they killed something, the zebra or the gazelle or whatever, they would use the meat to form coalitions with other people in their tribe. And so if they didn't give anything to someone, you know, it meant that other person, people were left over and so on. So it was a very political thing. And it stayed to our days. You know, that's why people, steaks, especially in Washington, places like that, steaks symbolizes power. And that's why politicians go for a steak. And there are so many steakhouses in Washington and not so many, you know, vegan or vegetarian cafes, because meat symbolizes this power and wealth.
Yeah, so such a status symbol of wealth, and then I guess developing countries imitate that also, and then, you know, as they get wealthier, they want to do the wrong thing also and eat meat. That's the status symbol. Huh?
Oh, yeah, that's a huge thing. You know, Asia is getting hooked on meat extremely fast nowadays, and a huge reason for that is exactly that. Just like the medieval, you know, poor people in Middle Ages were looking up to aristocracy and seeing them eating all this meat and they wanted to do the same thing. Nowadays, people in Asia, you know, they are looking up to the West. They want to be like us. They want to be, you know, westernized. So
we need to take a break. Mm-hmm. We're talking to Marta Zareska. Her book is Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. We'll continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Register now at worldvegansummit.com before the prices go up on register. Continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and don't forget, registration prices go up tomorrow night, so register now, save money for the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Go to WorldVeganSummit.com. Today we are talking to Marta Zareska. She is the author of Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Earlier we were discussing how meat consumption, you know, the flesh and blood, was the domain of the wealthy, and that it's been a status symbol, Marta. You talk about meat symbolizing power. There's a lot of you know, symbolizing that goes on with meat, and it's power over others and masculinity. And
yes, that's absolutely correct. That is actually the most important reason why vast majority of people have trouble giving up meat, and this is the symbolism that came to be attached to meat over these millions of years that humans have been eating meat and craving it, because it was such a rare food that gave you the power, because you had something that others wanted and you could share it or you could not share it, or, you know, and with whom you could share it and so on. And also the masculinity part that you mentioned is extremely important, because of course, you know, when 2 million years ago or 1 million years ago our ancestors were hunting meat, that was mostly men that were doing it, because they were simply bigger than women and stronger, so they had the meat. And because it was such a crazed food, you know, nutritious, caloric, and so on, they had the power once again. And they could share it with women or not. And it came to symbolize masculinity because of that. They had the need. And it's still sold to us nowadays the same way. You know, if you look at advertisements for example, McDonald's or Burger King or Taco Bell, there are many companies, fast food companies, that advertise meat as something that's special food for men. You know, even things, there was an advertisement for Hummer cars that used the same symbolism, you know, that meat symbolizes power and wealth. There was this advertisement in which a vegan guy had to buy himself a Hummer car to make himself feel more masculine because, you know, eating vegan was not enough. So he had to have a big, you know, fancy gas-guzzling car to feel masculine again, which is absurd, right? But we have this connection, and the meat industry is playing on it because they know the symbolism of meat, and they're exactly playing on that. And this is also why for many men it may be harder to give up meat, because meat symbolizes masculinity, and if you stop eating meat, you know, they feel they are not masculine anymore, and they are being even made fun by other guys. You know, there's something that women don't have to deal with, and it's a little bit easier for them to stop eating meat.
So a salad isn't masculine? I thought a salad was like the symbol of masculinity.
I wish it was that way, but unfortunately, you know, this is why it would be great if everybody was vegan, but the reality is, you know, that vegans are still the vast, you know, minority, and the vast majority of people are eating a lot of meat, and one of the reasons for that is this meaning, symbolism of meat as food for men, the masculinity.
And that goes across different cultures, right? I mean, it's a symbol of masculinity in many cultures.
Yeah, basically everywhere, because once again, it goes back to those 2.5 million years ago when we started eating meat, and the men were the ones who were providing it. So you know, it's very, very deeply rooted in human culture and the mind. So it's something that's really hard to get rid of, especially if the meat industry is using it, playing on it, and, you know, and reinforcing this message with their advertising.
Mm. Well, heart attacks are very masculine also, apparently. So that's,
and also, you know, ironically, studies show that men who eat meat have, for example, lower sperm quality. You know, so in a way,
right? Dysfunction. It's dysfunctional in many ways, I think, right? So, okay, time for another break. We'll continue our discussion with Marta Zareska. Her book, Meat Hooked: The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Up next hour, Professor Gary Francione. Don't forget, register now at worldvegansummit.com. Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com. We are live Sundays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific time. You can click Listen Live at GoVeganRadio.com. We're syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, GCNLive.com. You can visit that site and see the dozens and dozens of other programs there. We are the apparently the first food program on the network. And I didn't even realize we were a food program, but maybe. We are a vegan program for sure, and certainly we have no hidden agenda here. We want everyone to go vegan and eliminate meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. from our diet and not wear animals and not use animals. And that's why we're having the World Vegan Summit and Expo on the campus of UC Berkeley. And we'd like you to join us there at the end of July. Go to worldvegansummit.com. We have our work set out for us because apparently this population has been hooked on meat for about 2.5 million years, but we can get over it. We really think about it, you know, decomposing body parts. Ah. Today we're talking to Marta Zaraska, who is the author of Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. And so, Marta, we're talking that there's a lot of symbolism associated with the consumption of meat and how... you know, there's masculinity and the wealthy consume meat and we want to be like the wealthy. So, you know, although we don't have the health care the wealthy do, you know, to treat the diseases that their meat eating, meat, dairy, fish and eggs will cause. But anyway, so we were talking about how you get a certain power from meat. And you also say that, well, there's the power over nature and the power over other nations with meat eating.
Yes, so over nature, there's a big part of, you know, the appeal that meat has held for our ancestors for a long time. That's because, you know, when you think about it, if you kill an animal, you show your power over it. And it's not as easy to kill an animal as it's to kill, let's say, a lettuce, you know, or a carrot. So you show your strength, you know, why I'm so powerful, I can kill you. Some anthropologists actually say that this fact that this meat symbolizes power over animals, over nature, makes it absurdly more appealing that the, you know, the blood aspect and of the meat, you know, the bloody steaks, makes them more appealing because, you know, you're showing your power. And unfortunately, this is what has been appealing to humans for a very long time, because we like to show our power over nature and, you know, that we are better than it. And killing plants, you know, it doesn't have the same appeal. And once again, it goes back to those, you know, steak houses in Washington. This is the same appeal, you know, that the bloody, you know, powerful, I'm so strong, I could kill you aspect of meat eating.
Right, and yet they're killing tame, gentle animals. You know, I mean, it's not like they're killing carnivores or big cats or, you know, like lions or tigers. Well, you know, for food, I mean, the cow is just standing there. The pigs, the chickens, the, you know, wow, I'm powerful. You know, but nature will win in the end. I think you know, if we go at this rate with the, you know, climate change and resource depletion and all, you know, nature. Extinction could be nature's big joke on us, maybe.
In a way, you could say it, but unfortunately, a lot of nature is going to suffer as well. You know, that's why climate change is connected to the sixth extinction, so there will be a lot of nature falling victim to our meat-eating ways as well, because it's not just that, you know, the nature will win over us, but unfortunately, a lot of species will be wiped out at the same time. So for me, this environmental aspect of meat eating is the biggest motivator, you know, to for a change, because, you know, if we think about it, if everybody stopped eating meat overnight, we would have maybe not solved our climate change problems, but we have definitely gave ourselves a few decades to solve them. It's a huge thing. So, you know, basically going meat, you know, vegan overnight would have had much more impact with most of the things we are doing right now to solve climate change. And yet, vast majority of humanity doesn't want to do that, which is absurd because it's so easy. And at the same time, it would have helped us tremendously. It's equivalent, you know, meat eating is as responsible for climate change as all the transportation on Earth combined, so all the cars, planes, ships, scooters and everything. So we stop eating meat, and it's equivalent as there was no transportation on the Earth at all. So, you know, all these electric cars we're trying to make, this is nothing comparing to making people stop eating meat. And yet, and it's so much easier in a way to stop eating meat, and yet most people don't want to do that, and that's quite absurd.
Well, see, and I go by the scientists Robert Goodland and Jeff Anhang at the World Bank, who, you know, tell us that animal agriculture is the number one cause of climate change. responsible for at least 51% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. So if they are correct, and nobody else has proven to be more correct than they are at this point, 51% doesn't just mean more than all transportation. It means more than everything, right? It's more than, you know, if it's at least 51%. So that's good Linda Nanhang from the World Bank. And then the power of meat over other countries. What did you mean? What do you mean by that in your book?
So it basically goes again to the same thing. You know, I have meat, I'm powerful, I'm wealthy, kind of symbolism of meat. And that's, you know, for in history there is plenty of, you know, proof showing that people were thinking that if they are meat eaters, they are better than others. And it went even to nations. So, for example, in historical accounts, there are many, you know, passages saying that, you know, that, for example, the British thought they were a more powerful and stronger nation than other nations because they were eating meat, so they could rule them. And this was the reason why, for example, they were ruling India and not the other way around. That's what they thought, because they were eating meat, so they were strong and powerful, and the Hindus were not. They were vegetarians or vegans, so they were weak. And absurdly, actually, even Indians felt the same way. They thought they, at some point in 19th century, many intellectuals in India blamed their vegan diet for the fact that they were the ones who were ruled by the British. Even Mahatma Gandhi at some point believed that. He actually started eating meat when he was a young man because he wanted to become powerful as the British. Of course, later on, you know, he started thinking more and reading more about the diet, and he went back to vegetarianism. But even he tried eating meat to make himself stronger and more powerful.
Wow, it's got such a powerful symbolism to it that it can do that to people. So, the website is meathookedthebook.com, meathookedthebook.com. So, in researching the book or writing it, tell us about some of the interesting aspects that occurred to you or you researched that I didn't ask because I didn't know that they're in there, or that you came across them, or.
So, definitely, you know, when I was researching the book, I just discovered how many things that are making it hard for many people to give up meat. Because, you know, when you think about it, you know, there are, of course, for some people it's easy, and they go just vegan, and they stay with their diet, and it's great. But when you look around you, you know, vast majority of people are not doing it. And especially for vegans and vegetarians, those who are trying to, you know, convince other people to follow their diet, it can be very frustrating. You know, why aren't they doing it? You know, it seems obvious, right? It's better for the planet. It's better for the animals. Obviously, nobody wants to be eaten. It's better for our health. And yet, you know, look around you. Nobody, like vast majority of people, they just say, I love meat. You know, I don't want to give up meat. I want my steak. And they don't do that, right? So when I was researching the book, I discovered, you know, how many reasons there are for it. And this is not just the symbolism, you know, there's the marketing of the meat industry. There are, you know, the taste of meat, the particular mixture of flavors in meat that keep human taste, particularly appealing to human taste buds and make it, you know, harder for many people to give up meat. And, you know, there is, you know, even some genetical parts. So there is many, many reasons. And I think that, you know, and also psychological, you know, the way our brains operate, the you know, how we deal with cognitive dissonance of eating meat, that makes it easier for people to keep doing that. So the researching that, it showed me, you know, how important it is for people to understand why others are eating meat, especially if you want them to stop doing that. You have to understand where they are coming from and what makes it difficult for them. Because once you know it, it's easier, you know, to untangle it and to change their ways. Because, you know, just saying just don't do that is just not working. You know, we look, you know, for so many years, even in 19th century vegetarian leaders were trying to, people like, for example, John Harvey Kellogg, who was a vegetarian, you know, they were trying to make people stop eating meat. And they basically failed because, you know, the vast crowds didn't follow them. So if we know what makes it difficult for people, it can help us to change their way.
Well, it's so indoctrinated. I mean, really, so for what should be repulsive to us is indoctrinated at such a young age, and you know, all of the marketing, the billions of dollars that go into selling us on meat. I mean, it's really ingrained in our society. So
even the way parents feed their children is important. For example, studies show that what mothers eat when they are pregnant, you know, flavors their amniotic fluid and makes the child like this kind of food more. So if a pregnant woman is eating meat, she's kind of setting her children to liking the flavor of meat. So it goes back to so early on, right? So there is enough cause when parents feed their children, even the facial expressions they make when they're feeding them particular food are extremely important. So if they eat meat and say, good, you know, and then if they eat vegetables and they kind of may, flinch a little, but the children are registering all that, and this is how they're learning that some foods, you know, are supposed to be better for them and are supposed to be more liked. And so these are, you know, so powers in society and culture that make it difficult for many people to stop doing it.
Yeah. And even, you know, you come out with the World Health Organization telling us it's carcinogenic, you know. So, okay, well, Marta, I appreciate your being with us here today. I want to thank you again. The book is Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 million year obsession with meat. We have to end it. We have to end it soon. MeatHookedTheBook.com. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Okay. We'll continue. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Facebook GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden, and the extraneous two other Bob Linden pages, so I can have 10,000 more friends, and World Vegan Summit and Expo, where we hope thousands of people will join us so that we can help the world go vegan. When you come out to the Bay Area, many great vegan restaurants abound. Vegetarian House is in San Jose, so not quite near us in Berkeley, but worth a little trip if you have an extended vacation happening here in the Bay Area. If you want to be sure that you're patronizing an establishment whose owners will not retire and open a slaughterhouse and meat, dairy, and egg market, you can be sure at Vegetarian House, 100% vegan restaurant in San Jose. You can be sure of that, of that Loving Hut also, right? Of all the Loving Hut and Golden Lotus in Oakland, Solely Vegan for that matter in Oakland. You know, none of these owners will ever take your money, retire, and open a slaughterhouse. I can guarantee it. I wish I could have said that about Cafe Gratitude and Gracias Madre. But no gracias a madre on that one. And that's the gratitude we get. But I would like to express my gratitude for support from Vegetarian House, which is 100% vegan, organic, non-GMO, one of the best vegan restaurants in the world. Check it out. 520 East Santa Clara Street in San Jose. And Vegetarian House caters. So if you have an event coming up, a business event, social event, a wedding, make sure the food is great. Check out the menu also at vegetarianhouse.us. Again, 520 East Santa Clara Street. Wonderful restaurant. By the way, at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, we will have Van out there, Van Dang, who is the chef at Golden Lotus. She will be doing a food demonstration. And then actually the owner of Solely Vegan, Tamira Dyson, will be co-hosting Soul Food for Thought, our program on Saturday evening. She'll be co-hosting with Kenneth G. Williams, the first ever champion vegan bodybuilder. And we will have amazing presentations at Soul Food for Thought Saturday evening from Antenna Roba, MD, president of the International Fund for Africa, and Milton Mills, MD, and we'll also turn it into a reggae party with L'Amour and the Mystic Band. So Saturday night, the whole weekend is going to be amazing. And by the way, thanks to Dixie May for a donation in support of the World Vegan Summit and Expo. You can click donate at goveganradio.com if you'd like to support our event, our grassroots event. Dixie May making that donation in loving memory of her husband, Stan, who died last year at the age of 90. Dixie, who has been vegan for 57 years, married to Stan for 56 years, and they had a vision of a vegan world. So help us make that happen by joining us at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Go to worldvegansummit.com. And the prices are going up tomorrow, Monday, May 2nd, tomorrow evening. So you can save money. Register now at worldvegansummit.com. And by the way, we have... you know, it's official now. We will be doing a walk, really kicking off the festivities. I mean, the expo will open 10 o'clock on Friday morning, July 29th. We're there July 29th, 30th, and 31st on the campus of the University of California in Berkeley. But we have decided we'll start the festivities with a walk. The first ever Vegan Because We Care walk. And we will meet at 11:30 in historic People's Park, which is nearby. It'll be a walk of about a mile. We'll come down Telegraph and go to Bancroft, up Bancroft, across College onto the campus, and down Sproul to Lower Sproul, where the expo will be. By the way, Herbivore Restaurant is just a few blocks from People's Park. It opens at 9. So if you wanted to have breakfast there, it's a vegan restaurant. Pancakes, French toast, scrambled tofu. So anyway, worldvegansummit.com. We'll be talking to Professor Gary Francione, who will be there. He's coming up on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linton. Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linton. And we are joined now, as we are every week at this time, for commentary with Professor Gary Francione. And Professor Francione will again play a central role at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, where we will not only talk the talk, but we are going to walk the walk. Professor Francione, I just finished... talking the talk with the city of Berkeley on Friday. So we are actually going to have the Vegan Because We Care walk Friday morning, July 29th, from historic People's Park to the World Vegan Summit and Expo on campus. So the first ever walk of its kind.
Wait, what's it going to be called?
The Vegan Because We Care walk.
Good, good. Okay, yes, I think that's what we talked about, you, Anna, and I, because I was very worried that it was going to be vegan pride, and I have to go sort of hide myself under a rock.
It's not vegan pride. It's vegan because we care, and so we're going to meet at People's Park, and we'll have a nice, it's about a mile walk, so it'll probably take about a half hour through, you know, a good part of Berkeley there, and I think we should all get together and walk on behalf of the cause of going vegan.
You know, I was asked recently, somebody said, I had made the comment saying that we were going to have an event like that, and that Anna and I had spoken with you, and we had talked about a number of options, and I said the one I really just didn't like was the vegan pride. And somebody said, well, why do you, you know, have such a strong reaction? And I said, well, think about it. I mean, why? I mean, if being vegan is something that we all ought to do, because if animals matter morally, veganism is the only, you know, rational response. Why should we be proud of that? I mean, it's like saying, well, you know, I don't engage in other forms of fundamental rights violations, and I'm proud of that. Well, I'm not proud. I mean, the idea of it focuses it too much on us, and I think it really doesn't capture the moral obligation of it. This is not something to be proud of. It's something to just do because it's the right thing. But I want to talk a little bit tonight about something that comes up all the time, Bob, and we're going to talk about it at the World Vegan Summit. It's a simple idea. I've talked about it before, and I talk about this all the time, but it's something that needs to be reinforced all the time because of the movement being what it is right now, which is a tremendously confused. Veganism, a question I get a lot is, what is abolitionist veganism? Why do you have why do you call it that? And, you know, it's veganism. And the answer is, well, yeah, no. And it is, yes. You know, I'm glad if anybody's a vegan. I'm glad if anybody does not eat any animal products or wear any animal products or use any animal products. But the reason why somebody does that is important. It's important for a bunch of reasons. First of all, it's important because as a cultural matter, if we are not observing abolition or what I call abolitionist veganism, we're not pursuing veganism as a matter of justice, as a principle of justice. The main organizations, the animal organizations, promote veganism to the extent that they do. They promote veganism as a way of reducing suffering. This is something that doesn't really focus on the individual animal and the interest that the individual animal has in his or her life. And the reason why this is the prominent or predominant form of veganism in amongst all of these new welfare groups is that reflects the philosophical idea that came from Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century, and that is still represented strongly in the work of Peter Singer, and is the dominant way of thinking, which is that animals don't have an interest in life. They have an interest in not suffering. And that fundamental sort of metaphysical belief informs what veganism is for these large groups. So veganism becomes simply a way of reducing suffering. And if you don't think that the individual animal has an interest in continuing to live, then I suppose it makes sense. I wouldn't agree with it, and I would not even subscribe to it, even if I did believe, because I think that you know, you'll never be able to, even if animals don't have an interest in continuing to live, let's assume arguendo that they don't have an interest in continuing to live, it's still the case that you'll never reduce suffering completely. You'll never eliminate suffering if you're using animals. So there'll always be some level of suffering, even in the most ideal situation. So I wouldn't accept the philosophical framework at all. But the issue is, I think, the modern movement, and the modern movement which traces its roots to the 19th century and to Jeremy Bentham's thinking, the modern movement sees animals as not having an interest in continuing to live and only having an interest in not suffering. So that being the case, the approach that these groups use makes sense, but is wrong. And it makes sense in the sense that, well, you know, cage-free eggs, crate-free pork, these are all ways of reducing suffering. Well, in some abstract sense, I guess that may be true. And there may be like a one 1/1000th of a reduction of suffering if you go from battery cages to a cage-free system, which where you've got like a barn being one large cage. Maybe there is a slight reduction of suffering, but if you're looking,
but only in our eyes, by the way, I would say, because the hens in the shed with the tens of thousands of others will be 100% miserable. So they're not going to say, "Wow, I could have been in a cage." You know what I mean?
Well, no,
it could have been worse.
Right,
you know,
right. They're not going to know. But I mean, I guess the response to that would be, well, would they be less happy if you put them in a battery cage, in a conventional battery cage? And the answer is, I know that there are some studies. I believe that there are some studies, and I'm not sure that the I know how the evidence has been characterized, but I have seen stuff that goes both ways. But the yes, I mean, you're right, but the issue is whether or not they would be less. They're suffering horribly in a cage-free system, but would they suffer more if you put them in a conventional cage? You know, and so let's assume that they would. Let's assume that they would suffer more. Well, I understand if you think that this is only about reducing suffering, then you could say, well, you know, if you give them a bigger cage, or if you put them in a cage-free system, or you give them, you put them in a free-range situation, which is another amorphous term, they're going to suffer less. But if you see them as individuals, it's not a question of reducing suffering. It's a question of justice, of their interest in their life and or their lives, and their interest in satisfying their interests. They have an interest that their interests be satisfied, that their preferences be satisfied generally, and that they continue to exist. And if you see things that way, then you know, you look at veganism as in a different way, because you see, for us, for you, for me, and for people who follow abolitionist veganism, it really wouldn't matter if somebody could convince you. And I realize the bar would be high because with both. But let's assume someone could convince us that an animal was raised in a completely humane way and was killed in a completely painless way. Now, I believe that's very near to impossible, and it's absolutely impossible when you're talking about doing things on a large scale. But let's assume that just for argument purposes, that it could be done, you know, that you have an animal that has been raised without any suffering and is killed without any pain. Well, if you believe that it's just a matter of suffering, then you don't see anything wrong with eating that animal or exploiting that animal if the animal has not suffered at all, either in terms of the raising of the animal or in terms of the killing of the animal. Nothing bad has happened because you haven't taken anything away, because if they have no interest in continuing to live and they don't really know what it means to have a life, you have deprived them of nothing by taking theirs. And that's really, in a sense, what Bentham thought and what Singer thinks. And so, you know, it's odd that, you know, he's the father of the animal rights movement, but, you know, but that's basically what he thinks. You're not taking anything away from them. And so if you believe that, I could understand how you would say, well, there's been no moral harm. For us, there would be a moral harm in that situation, because even if you could raise the animal painlessly, and even if you could kill the animal with no pain whatsoever, no pain in life, no pain in raising, no pain in death, even in that situation, it would be wrong to kill the animal, because you are taking something from the animal. You're taking the animal's life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in many ways, I do not think this can. I think it's wrong to think that we can answer this question empirically. You cannot answer the question empirically about whether a being values his or her life, particularly when you're talking about a being who does not use symbolic communication, i.e. language. You're never really going to, I mean, in many ways, it's not an empirical idea. It's in certain ways a philosophical idea. You know, if you're essential, I mean, for me, I think it's quite, I mean, it's quite simple. If you're a sentient being, you have an interest in continuing to live because sentience is a means to the ends of continuing to live. So to say that you're a sentient being and you don't have an interest in continuing to live is like saying you have eyes, but you don't have an interest in continuing to see. You have sentience, not as some sort of abstract characteristic or property. You have it because it is you have evolved to have it because it is something that helps you stay alive and prosper.
So I don't see too many animals committing suicide, you know what I mean?
That's exactly right. And so...
It looks like we need to take a break, but we'll continue our discussion with Professor Gary Francione. Join us at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Register now at worldvegansummit.com. Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Facebook, GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden. Register now for the World Vegan Summit and Expo at WorldVeganSummit.com. We are talking to Professor Gary Francione. I'm just wondering about how this statement applies to, like, I'm thinking, well, if I'm a vegan, I might want to do this to reduce suffering, but doesn't that... Reducing suffering doesn't mean reducing the suffering of living animals. Wouldn't I want... I don't want there to be a demand for animals. I want to reduce suffering and killing, so I would like there to be no demand for animals to be born to be eaten. Is that a proper way of looking at...
Well, I think... You know, I mean, look, there's a whole bunch of doctrines that come into play that alleviate the responsibility of people... for example, they say, well, animals don't have an interest in continuing to live as long as I'm reducing suffering, or, you know, and then the other thing is, well, I can't reduce suffering completely. They'll always be suffering. So, you know, I'm just trying to minimize it. And I mean, there's all sorts of excuses. As a matter of fact, I posted something in the past couple of days that, you know, if you took all of the energy that animal people put into coming up with excuses about, you know, for why they don't have to regard veganism as a moral imperative. If you took all the energy that goes into one day of animal people thinking about excuses about why they don't have to be vegan, you could light up Manhattan for a month. And because, you know, there's a lot of energy. I mean, this is something I deal with all the time with the new welfarists and all of their manifestations, because, you know, basically, you know, they're abolitionists, and then there's everybody else, and you know, the everybody else, you know, they're all coming, trying to come up with some excuse or other to sort of get away from the idea that veganism is a moral imperative. And so, you know, I think it's very sad that, you know, every day I see the stuff that comes out of animal groups and animal people and whatnot, and it's very sad that animal people just are so intent on coming up with excuses. You know, it's an excusitarian movement, as it were. And but, you know, this is one of the things we're going to talk about at the World Vegan Summit, is the idea of veganism as justice, because that's really how we need. And I've been talking about this for years now, but this is probably the thing I talk most with people about, because everybody thinks, well, veganism is veganism, and the answer is no, it's not. Because if I'm a new welfarist vegan, then basically, I might be vegan most of the time, but I don't see it as something that I need to adhere to as a moral principle in all cases. You know, that's the problem. That's why you get all the time, the question about backyard eggs. I'm sure you probably get that 50,000 times a day, just like I do. But, as a matter of fact, I was giving a talk yesterday by Skype to a wonderful group of people in Oklahoma. And that question came up, what about backyard chicken? And the answer is, first of all, there is suffering involved in that. And secondly, there is lots of, the chickens don't just all of a sudden magically appear. You know, they're hatched and 50% of them are male and they're killed. And, I went into all of that. But, a lot of people find that an intuitively plausible way of exploiting animals because they say, well, but there's no suffering involved. And if you let them live, there's basically no suffering involved. And the answer is, yeah, but if this is an issue of justice, then should we be exploiting these animals at all, even if we're not making them suffer in any, in any acute way? And it's also like, it goes to it's related to the question, what if I'm dumpster diving and I find a hamburger and it's fresh? Is it okay for me to eat it? Because I'm not creating demand. That goes to an issue you were talking about before about creating demand. Well, and I respond to that all the time by saying, what if you were dumpster diving and you found a nice fresh human arm and it was really nice and warm and still very soft and would it be okay to eat? And the answer is no, it wouldn't be okay to eat because human arms are not things to eat.
That's how I look at it. Not food. I don't even. There's no temptation.
That's right.
We
need to be thinking of eggs as not things that we eat. And
right.
Animals,
exactly. I hear the music. I guess we're out of time, so we'll continue.
The World Vegan Summit. Come on, everybody. We're going to have a wonderful time talking about veganism is a matter of justice.
As justice. Register now.